This is Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This opening music is courtesy of Joseph Martin, Professor of Music at the Lamont School of Music at Denver University. Welcome to the poetry section of the bookshelf. I've selected some poems that have inspired me and others, and I hope you'll enjoy listening to them again or for the first time. The Poetry Corner. We start the program today with a story of a boy coming from Irish-Scottish immigrants, Strickland Gilliland. He was born in Ohio in 1869 and later attended Ohio University, where he had two close friends, Cassius Shepherd and Arthur Johnson. One day, while addressing the undergraduates, the president of the university, Dr. Charles Super, pointed a solemn finger at the three and said, "Gilliland, Shepherd, and Johnson, I haven't the slightest doubt that the three of you will end up in the penitentiary." Well, they didn't. Shepherd became a noted orthopedic surgeon. Johnson became editor and associate publisher of the Columbus Dispatch, and Gilliland became a newspaperman, president of the American Press Humorists, and poet. Here follows his story of two Irishmen who worked for the railroad, Finnegan and Flanagan. Superintendent was Flanagan. Boss of the section was Finnegan. Whenever the cars got off in the track and muddled up things to the devil and back, Finnegan rid it to Flanagan after the wreck was all on again. That is, this Finnegan reported to Flanagan. When Finnegan first writ to Flanagan, he read in 10 pages, did Finnegan, and he told just how the smash occurred, for many a tedious blundering word did Finnegan write to Flanagan after the cars had gone on again. That was how Finnegan reported to Flanagan. Now, Flanagan knowed more than Finnegan. He'd more education, had Flanagan. And he wore him clean and completely out to tell what Finnegan writ about in his writing to Muster Flanagan. So he writ it back to Finnegan, "Don't do such a sin again. Make him brief, Finnegan." When Finnegan got this from Flanagan, he blushed rosy red, did Finnegan. And he said, "I'll gamble a whole month's pay that it'll be a many a day before superintendent," that's Flanagan, "gets a whack at this very same sin again, from Finnegan to Flanagan. Reports won't be long again." One day on the section of Finnegan, on the road superintended by Flanagan, a rail gave way on a bit of a curve, and some cars went off as they made the swerve. "There's nobody hurt," says Finnegan, "but reports must be made to Flanagan." And he winked at McGorgan as Mary to Finnegan. He was shandying thin, was Finnegan, and many old railroaders been again. And the smoky old lamp was burning bright in Finnegan's shanty all that night, biling down his report, was Finnegan. And he writed this here. "Mr. Flanagan, off again, on again, gone again, Finnegan." The following piece, written by Hugh Darcy, was first published in 1887 and was titled "The Face Upon the Floor." It is amusing to note that it was never intended to point out the perils of strong drink, but merely to portray the degradation of an artist tortured by the loss of his sweetheart. The poem was seized by the WCTU and later the Anti-Saloon League, and the title altered to "The Face on the Barroom Floor." Millions of copies were distributed as propaganda. In 1925, Darcy commented, "If I thought my poem had done anything to help Prohibition, I would go take a running jump into the Hudson." The Face on the Barroom Floor. 'Twas a balmy summer evening, and a goodly crowd was there, which well-nigh filled Joel's barroom on the corner of the square. And as songs and witty stories came through the open door, a vagabond crept slowly in and posed upon the floor. "Where did it come from?" someone said. "The wind has blown it in." "What does it want?" another cried. "Some whiskey, rum, or gin? Here, Toby Sitcom, if your stomach's equal to the work, I wouldn't touch him with a fork. He's filthy as a Turk." His bandage the poor rich took with stoical good grace, In fact, he smiled as though he thought he'd struck the proper place. "Come, boys, I know there's kindly hearts among so good a crowd. To be in such good company would make a deacon proud. Give me a drink, that's what I want. I'm out of funds, you know. When I had cash to treat the gang, this hand was never slow. What, you laugh as if you thought this pocket never held a sou? I once was fixed as well, my boys, as any one of you. There, thanks. That's braced me nicely. God bless you, one and all. Next time I pass this good saloon, I'll make another call. Give you a song? No, I can't do that. My singing days are past. My voice is cracked, my throat's worn out, and my lungs are going fast. I'll tell you a funny story, and a fact, I promise, too. Say, give me another whiskey, and I'll tell you what I'll do. That I was ever a decent man, not one of you would think, but I was some 4 or 5 years back. Say, give me another drink. Fill her up, Joe, I want to put some life into my frame. Such little drinks to a bum like me are miserably tame. Five fingers, there, that's the scheme, and corking whiskey, too. Well, here's luck, boys, and landlord, my best regards to you. You've treated me pretty kindly, and I'd like to tell you how I came to be the dirty sot you see before you now. As I told you once, I was a man with muscle, frame, and health, and but for a blunder ought to have made considerable wealth. I was a painter, not one that daubed on bricks and wood, but an artist, and for my age was rated pretty good. I worked hard at my canvas, and was bidding fair to rise, for gradually I saw the star of fame before my eyes. I made a picture, perhaps you've seen, 'tis called The Chase of Fame. It brought me £1,500, and added to my name. And then I met a woman, now comes the funny part, with eyes that petrified my brain and sunk into my heart. Why don't you laugh? 'Tis funny that the vagabond you see could ever love a woman and expect her love for me. But 'twas so, and for a month or two her smiles were freely given, and when her loving lips touched mine, it carried me to heaven. Boys, did you ever see a girl for whom your soul you'd give? With a form like a Milo Venus, too beautiful to live. With eyes that would beat the Koh I Noor, and a wealth of chestnut hair. If so, 'twas she, for there never was another half so fair. I was working on a portrait one afternoon in May of a fair-haired boy, a friend of mine who lived across the way. And Madeline admired it, and much to my surprise, said she'd like to know the man that had such dreamy eyes. It didn't take long to know him, and before the month had flown, my friend had stole my darling, and I was left alone. And ere a year of misery had passed above my head, the jewel I had treasured so had tarnished and was dead. That's why I took to drink, boys, why I never see you smile. I thought you'd be amused and laughing all the while. Why, what's the matter, friend? There's a teardrop in your eye. Come, laugh like me. 'Tis only babes and women that should cry. Say, boys, if you give me just another whiskey, I'll be glad, and I'll draw right here a picture of the face that drove me mad. Give me that piece of chalk with which you mark the baseball score. You shall see the lovely Madeline upon the barroom floor. Another drink, and with chalk in hand, the vagabond began to sketch a face that well might buy the soul of any man. Then as he placed another lock upon the shapely head, with a fearful shriek, he leaped and fell across the picture, dead. From Edgar Allan Poe, the author of The Raven, comes another poem of lost love, Annabel Lee. It was many and many a year ago in the kingdom by the sea that a maid there lived whom you may know by the name of Annabel Lee. And this maiden she lived with no other thought than to love and be loved by me. I was a child, and she was a child in this kingdom by the sea, and we loved with a love that was more than love, I and my Annabel Lee, with a love that the winged seraphs of heaven coveted her and me. And this was the reason that long ago in this kingdom by the sea, A wind blew out of a cloud, chilling my beautiful Annabel Lee. So then her high-born kinsman came and bore her away from me to shut her up in a sepulcher in this kingdom by the sea. The angels not half so happy in heaven when envying her and me. Yes, that was the reason, as all men know, in this kingdom by the sea, that the wind came out of the cloud by night, chilling and killing my Annabel Lee. But our love, it was stronger by far than the love of those who were older than we, of many far wiser than we. And neither the angels in heavens above nor the demons down under the sea can ever dissever my soul from the soul of the beautiful Annabel Lee, for the moon never beams without bringing me dreams of the beautiful Annabel Lee. And the stars never rise, but I see the bright eyes of the beautiful Annabel Lee. And so, all the night tide, I lie down by the side of my darling, my life and my bride, in her sepulcher there by the sea, in her tomb by the sounding sea. Elizabeth Barrett Browning was first published in 1838, and she was considered as a rival of Tennyson for the role of poet laureate following the death of Wordsworth. She met writer Robert Browning in 1845 and secretly married him. Her father disapproved, and the couple moved to Italy in 1846, and she spent the rest of her life in Italy. Her work, How Do I Love Thee? How do I love thee? Let me count the ways. I love thee to the depth and breadth and height my soul can reach when feeling out of sight for the ends of being and ideal grace. I love thee to the level of every day's most quiet need by sun and candlelight. I love thee freely as men strive for right. I love thee purely as they burn from praise. I love thee with a passion put to use in my old griefs and with my childhood's faith. I love thee with a love I seem to lose with my lost saints. I love thee with the breath, smiles, tears of my life. And if God choose, I shall but love thee better after death. Another work by Rudyard Kipling, The Female of the Species. This poem expresses the tenacity with which a woman holds on to the relationship with her family. When the Himalayan peasant meets the he-bear in his pride, he shouts to scare the monster, who will often turn aside. But the she-bear, thus accosted, rends the peasant tooth and nail, for the female of the species is more deadly than a male. When nagged basking cobra hears the careless foot of man, he will sometimes wriggle sideways and avoid it if he can. But his mate makes no such motion where she camps beside the trail, for the female of the species is more deadly than the male. When the early Jesuit fathers preached to Hurons and Choctaws, they prayed to be delivered from the vengeance of the squaws. 'Twas the women, not the warriors, turned those stark enthusiasts pale, for the female of the species is more deadly than the male. Man's timid heart is bursting with the things he must not say, for the woman that God gave him isn't his to give away. But when hunter meets with husband, each confirms the other's tale. The female of the species is more deadly than the male. Man a bear in most relations, worm and savage otherwise. Man propounds negotiations, man accepts the compromise. Very rarely will he squarely push the logic of a fact to its ultimate conclusions in unmitigated act. Fear or foolishness impels him, ere he lay the wicked low, to concede some form of trial even to his fiercest foe. Mirth obscene diverts his anger. Doubt and pity often perplex him in the dealing with an issue to the scandal of the sex. But the woman that God gave him, every fiber of her frame, proves her launched for one sole issue, armed and engined for the same. And to serve that single issue, lest the generations fail, the female of the species must be deadlier than the male. She who faces death by torture for each life beneath her breast may not deal in doubt or pity, must not swerve for fact or jest. These be purely male diversions, not in these her honor dwells. She, the other law we live by, is that law and nothing else. She can bring no more to living than the powers that make her great, as the mother of the infant and the mistress of the mate. And when babe and man are lacking, and she strives and claim to claim her right as femme and baron, her equipment is the same. She is wedded to convictions in default of grosser ties. Her contentions are her children. Heaven help him who denies. He will meet no suave discussion, but the instant white-hot wile waken female of the species warring for her spouse and child. Unprovoked and awful charges, even so the she-bear fights. Speech that grips corrodes and poisons, even so the cobra bites. Scientific vivisection of one nerve till it's raw, and the victim rise in anguish, like the Jesuit with the squaw. So it comes that man, a coward, when he gathers to confer with his fellow braves in council, dare not leave a place for her, where, at war with life and conscience, he uplifts his erring hands to some god of abstract justice, which no woman understands. And man knows it, knows, moreover, that the woman that God gave him must command, but may not govern, shall enthrall, but not enslave him. And she knows, because she warns him, and her instincts never fail, that the female of her species is more deadly than the male. It may be that that quality is not always appreciated by a man, as expressed in this next work by George F. Goodman, Ladies First. "Oh, do you mind," the lady said, "if I step in and go ahead? I hope that you will pardon me, but I am in a rush, you see. I'm going out today to dine. Would you give me your place in line?" And so I smile a gracious smile, and meekly bow and lift my tile. I do not mind just doing this. It helps to add to human bliss. But when the females all combine to come and take my place in line, my temper seems to soar and burst. Who wrote that saying, 'Ladies first'?" The best perspective may be from the eyes of love, as suggested in our next poem. The title of it may be familiar to you. It was the title of a very popular song from a generation ago, from Francis William Bourdillon, "The Night Has a Thousand Eyes." "The night has a thousand eyes and the day but one, yet the light of the bright world dies with the dying sun. The mind has a thousand eyes and the heart but one, yet the light of the whole life dies when love is done." Next, a work of Robert Louis Stevenson. His name may first conjure up thoughts of high adventure with pirates like Long John Silver and Old Ben Gunn on Treasure Island. Or it may bring up thoughts of childhood, as in The Child's Garden of Verse. But there was another side to Stevenson, as seen in this poem entitled, "My Wife." "Trusty, dusky, vivid, true, with eyes of gold and bramble dew, steel true and blade straight, the great artificer made my mate. Honor, anger, valor, fire, a love that life could never tire, death quench, or evil stir, the mighty master gave to her. Teacher, tender comrade, wife, a fellow farer, true through life, heart whole and soul free, the august father gave to me." And from the woman's point of view, "Success," by Charlotte Becker. "They said he was a failure, since he won nor eminence nor fame, and no one but his friends were stirred at any mention of his name. Ah, foolish ones, they could not gauge the measurement of his success. He left his friends glad memories and gave one woman happiness." Around 1910, there was a report from an association of Western state governors which carried notice of a dispute, geographically, as to where the West actually began. Arthur Chapman penned this poem as a response. It wasn't a place, it was a state of mind. "Out where the West begins. Out where the hand clasps a little stronger. Out where the smile dwells a little longer. That's where the West begins. Out where the sun is a little brighter. Where the snows that fall are a trifle whiter. Where the bonds of home are a wee bit tighter. That's where the West begins. Out where the skies are a trifle bluer, out where friendship's a little truer, that's where the West begins. Out where a fresher breeze is blowing, where there's laughter at every streamlet flowing, where there's more of reaping and less of sowing, that's where the West begins. Out where the world is in the making, where fewer hearts in despair are aching, that's where the West begins. Where there's more of singing and less of sighing, where there's more of giving and less of buying, and a man makes friends without half trying, that's where the West begins. From the poet of the American people, Eugene Field, some thoughts about getting away from it all. Vacation. It seems to me I'd like to go where bells don't ring, nor whistles blow, nor clocks don't strike, nor gongs don't sound, and I'd have stillness all around. No real stillness, but just the trees' low whispering, or the hum of bees, or a brook faint babbling over stones in strangely softly tangled tones. Or maybe a cricket or katydid, or the song of birds in hedges hid, or just such sweet sounds as these to fill the tired heart with ease. If it weren't for sight and sound and smell, I'd like a city pretty well. But when it comes to getting rest, I like the country lots the best. Sometimes it seems to me I must just quit the city's din and dust and get out where the sky is blue and say, how does it seem to you? Now some introspection into life by Edgar Guest, written in 1916 and entitled simply, Life. Life is a gift to be used every day, not to be smothered and hidden away. It isn't a thing to be stored in the chest where you gather your keepsakes and treasure your best. It isn't a joy to be sipped now and then and promptly put back in a dark place again. Life is a gift that the humblest may boast of, and one that the humblest may well make the most of. Get out and live it each hour of the day. Wear it and use it as much as you may. Don't keep it in ditches and corners and grooves. You'll find that in service, its beauty improves. The Old Song by Charles Kingsley. When all the world is young, lad, and all the trees are green, and every goose a swan, lad, and every lass a queen, then hay for boot and horse, lad, and round the world away. Young blood must have its course, lad, and every dog his day. When all the world is old, lad, and all the trees are brown, and all the sport is stale, lad, and all the wheels run down, creep home and take your place there, the spent and maimed among. God grant you find one face there you loved when all was young. And from a New York poet, Thomas S. Jones, Jr., first published in 1917, Sometimes. Across the fields of yesterday, he sometimes comes to me, a little lad just back from play, the lad I used to be. And yet he smiles so wistfully once he has crept within. I wonder if he hopes to see the man I might have been. Described as coming from the hearts and the homes of American people, like the dreams of childhood, never growing old or being forgotten. A work by James Whitcomb Riley. The Prayer Perfect. Dear Lord, kind Lord, gracious Lord, I pray, Thou wilt look on all I love tenderly today. Weed our hearts of weariness, scatter every care, down the wake of angels' wings winnowing the air. Bring unto the sorrowing all release from pain, let the lips of laughter overflow again. And with all the needy, O divine, I pray, this vast treasure of content that is mine today. Our next piece is by William Ernest Henley. In 1875, Mr. Henley had to have one of his legs amputated due to complications arising from tuberculosis. He was told that his other leg would have to suffer the same procedure. Instead, he enlisted the services of Dr. Joseph Lister, and after multiple surgical interventions, the leg was saved. During his recovery, Henley wrote the following piece, Invictus. Out of the night that covers me, black as the pit from pole to pole, I thank whatever gods may be for my unconquerable soul. In the fell clutch of circumstance, I have not winced nor cried aloud. Under the bludgeonings of chance, my head is bloody, but unbowed. Beyond this place of wrath and tears looms but the horror of the shade, and yet the menace of the years finds and shall find me unafraid. It matters not how straight the gate, how charged with punishments the scroll. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. And in conclusion, we offer what may be one poet's answer to the introspection. From E. Bell Guthrie, He'd Done His Damnedest. And as a preface to the poem, there is this quote from Harry Truman. He said, I always remember an epitaph in the cemetery in Tombstone, Arizona. It said, Here lies Jack Williams. He done his damnedest. I think that is the greatest epitaph a man can have, when he gives everything that is in him to do the job that is before him. That is all you can ask of it, and is what I've tried to do. I ask that when my spirit quits the shell of mortal clay, and o'er the trail across the range pursues its silent way, that no imposing marble shaft may mark the spot where rest the tailings of the bard who sang the praises of the West, but that above them may be placed a slab of white or gray, and on it but the epitaph carved in the earlier day upon the headboard of a man who did the best he could to have the bad deeds of his life o'ershadowed by the good. He'd done his damnedest. Engrave upon the polished face of that plain, simple stone no nicely worded sentiment intended to condone the sins of an eventful life, nor say that virtue's wiped away the stains of vice in lines original or swiped. That rough but honest sentiment that stood above the head of one who wore his boots into the final earthly bed is good enough for me to have above my moldering clay. Just give the name the day I quit, and underneath it say, He done his damnedest. Some who are overstocked with only piety may raise their hands in blank amazement at the sentiment and gaze upon the simple marble slab neath which the sleeper lies, with six or seven different kinds of horror in their eyes. But hardy sons and daughters of this brave and rugged West will see a tribute in the line so pointedly expressed. And what more earnest tribute could be paid to any man whose weary feet have hit the trail towards the mystery than, He done his damnedest. This is Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Thanks for listening in to this special part of the bookshelf, the Poetry Corner. If you have enjoyed this feature and would like to hear more, please call us at 919-832-5138. And if you have a favorite that you'd like to hear, do call and tell us about your favorite poetry. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. Until next time.